If you're out there, you're next on my list. You said you had a question or a topic, so please.
This is WHCDL with some information.
Oh, hello, Andy. Sure, give us information. We always like to hear information.
Okay, I'm not going to call it Andy's Corner just yet, but it could be a preview of it, because I always like to convey information that I read, especially in the, you know, the latest advances in science and technology. So if you want, I have a little article here that I could read from a QST magazine. It seems quite fascinating. It's from the last August, 2021's edition. Maybe you have read it, but I thought I'd convey it.
Sure, Andy. Are you in any time restraints? Because Rich is on my little list of questions or comments for tonight, and I, you know, if I can, I'd like to get to his question or comment. But if you're stuck for time, I guess we can push up.
No, go ahead. That's why I'm mentioning it. There's no hurry. You can squeeze me in. It's only a very short article. It's only one page. But it's quite fascinating to read, so I thought I'd share it. So put me on the list.
Okay, very good, Andy. Consider yourself on the list. So Jim must have stepped away from the radio. Hopefully he'll be back later. We'll be able to get to his question. Until then, Rich, W2BZ, what's your question or comment for tonight?
Wondered if you cut a dipole, if there's a certain frequency that a dipole should be cut to, if you cut the dipole longer, or in another case, if you cut the dipole shorter, which way, the shorter antenna or the longer antenna, would an antenna tuner have an easier time with? Go ahead. Am I clear on that? Go ahead.
Definitely longer. WP2AV.
Okay, Ed, so you said definitely longer is easier for the antenna tuner to transform the impedance to a nominal 50 ohms?
That has been my experience over decades. I mean, think of the limit. A 1 mile dipole would be multiple wavelengths, whereas a base load coupling. Good luck with that.
Okay, that's a good point. You know, like most things, if you kind of peel one level of the onion, you get another and another under that and another under that. Also, what I've talked with Rich about this in the past, and effectively, if your antenna is too long, it's effectively has too much inductive reactance, and the simple way of removing the excess inductive reactance is to introduce some additional capacitance. Capacitance usually has less insertion loss associated with it than the opposite. If it's a too short antenna, where you have to introduce inductive reactance. Inductive reactance tends to be a much more lossy component than a capacitor. So that's a factor as well. And, of course, you know, the situation where you're adjusting a non-resonant antenna introduces all kinds of interesting, you know, secondary effects. So although with a good enough antenna tuner and a low-loss transmission line, you can correct a lot of errors. I would tend to agree generally. If you can, it's always nice to make it longer. If you can't make it the right length, I think ultimately the best approach is to make it the best length for what you need. if you can get away with that. But otherwise, I think a longer antenna has somewhat more benefits.
One other point. Do not expect a textbook pattern. There are features readily available of a quarter wave ground plane vertical compared to a 5/8 wave ground plane vertical. And you'll see that the 5/8 wave is preferred because it sends more energy out nearer the horizon. So that's an example.
So are you saying in the case of a dipole, let's say on the low band, that it's insertion loss that makes the difference between a shorter one and a longer one, Roy?
What I am saying is do not expect a classic donut on a string antenna pattern if you don't have a dipole. Although on HF, it just changes. So maybe you won't hear Greece. Maybe you'll hear Morocco.
Yeah, what Ed is mentioning is when you have a longer than resonant radiator, you might be able to tweak it to have a resonant impedance 50 ohms and such and radiate most of the energy, but you will have a distortion of the radiation pattern rather than the simple donut shown for a dipole. You'll have something a little bit stranger. Some antennas have all kinds of complex multi-nodal modes where, if you're lucky, the direction you're looking for is particularly benefited, and it's not a zero node or close to a zero node. So it can get complicated. I'm a big fan as well of 5/8 vertical. I have a 10. Meter vertical, that's 5/8 of a wave. The 5/8 wave, when re-resonated for that length, allows the takeoff angle to be lower, so it skirts the horizon a little bit better, in most people's opinion, and can get you a little bit farther in some cases. So I, too, am a big fan of 5/8 wave. So almost, I don't think reality is, thankfully we can't see the radiation pattern of our antennas, because the antenna radiation patterns that are demonstrated in the software usually are theoretical in free space. We don't live in a theoretical world, and we don't live anywhere near really free space. So there are a lot of distortions to that in the real world.
How come you don't hear about 5/8 waves, or maybe you do, 5/8 waves dipoles?
Because you may not want that pattern.
Yeah, a 5/8 wave dipole is beneficial if you're going to vertically orient it. If you're going to horizontally orient it, you don't get any benefit from having a lower, say, takeoff angle at 90 degrees. So now you're not dealing with it skirting the horizon. You're dealing with a whole different thing at a 90-degree angle from that.
It's a squished donut.
What if you have a multiband dipole?
It goes short, even though the pattern won't be perfect. I got it. That's all, Roy. That's what I wanted to know. Go ahead.
KDQFIU?
Yes, George.
Look up extended double ZEP, and I'll leave it there, with 5/8 transmission. Just look up extended double ZEP and see what kind of gain you're going to have on a single band with that.
Yeah, but gain in this direction is a loss in some other direction.
No, just look it up. Look up and see what the antenna is. Because everybody's throwing this around with 5/8. Look up ZEP, double ZEP, and extended double ZEP. Too much to explain right now.
Will do, George. Thanks, W2BZ. Back to that.
getting back to something that Ed just mentioned, and I think that this is a very important point that I've mentioned more than a few times, and a lot of people have mentioned. Antennas are not active objects. They don't gain true additional power. They're passive devices. They simply rearrange your signal in different directions. So you'll have a geometric gain in certain areas of the radiation angle at the cost of others. Because, you know, in a theoretical isotropic antenna, it disperses somewhat like a light bulb over the entire volume around it. True antennas are not theoretical isotropic radiators, and so they squeeze their signal into smaller volumes of space at the benefit of increasing the field density in those areas and at the cost of decreasing the field density of others. That's why some people love Yagis, highly directional. All the energy, or most of the energy, is squeezed in a certain cone shape, and you can rotate it to the direction that you want to. So all antennas are passive devices. All gain mentioned are simply due to rearranging the distribution of the energy that's coming out of your transmitter and your transmission lines.
So let's throw off the punchline.
Please, give us the punchline.
A Yagi antenna gives you higher gain in the direction it's pointed and lower gain in all other directions.
Yeah, I think I mentioned that in a different way earlier. You look, there's no such thing as a free lunch, and that's physics 101. If you're going to get a gain in one direction, you have to get a decrease loss in another direction to balance it. Otherwise, you have a powered amplifier, and thankfully, you don't have to plug in your antenna, so it's not a powered unit. So passive units do not add any additional power to the transmission. They just redirect them in interesting ways that make for conversation on late-night technicalness.
KD2FIU?
Yes, George.
And a Yagi for transmitter.
Okay, I think Rich and George doubled, or I and George, or I and Rich. One of us doubled with each other. Anyway, do you want to repeat yourself, Rich? Because I only heard half of that.
That's why, because of the lack of gain off the back of the antenna or the sides of the antenna on a Yagi, that's why the big boys, like big contesters, they use verticals for listening because it's omnidirectional, and then swing their beams around to a signal when they want to catch a station. At least that's what I'm told. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's best to have omnidirectional ears and very, very directional transmission antennas for grabbing as far away as you can. George, you wanted to say something?
Depending on what bands you want to work, you don't have to be too technical to let it work. Having a 4075 meter antenna. Excuse me. A 4075, and then parallel to that, about 11 feet away, I have a 10, 15, and 20. What I've been experiencing is that in the middle of the night, I'm working 15 meters over the pole on the other side of the world without an amplifier, because I don't run amplifiers, with tremendous power. What's happening is that the 15-meter portion of the tribander that's 11 feet away, parallel to the using the 4080 as a director to get me over the pole. This all happened by accident. My contacts on the other side of the world, should I want to get up in the middle of the night and do this, are incredible. And this happened by accident. I don't have to explain to anybody out there who understands a little bit about antennas and third wave coupling how this happened. But you can be surprised what will happen with any structure around you. This, to me, happened with two antennas that were specifically designed. Keep in mind, this can happen with gutters, downspouts, or anything like that. You design an antenna, you design two antennas. Sometimes they'll cancel each other out. Sometimes they will act in a very, very positive way.
Okay, very good, George. So, Rich, you got some answers. Ultimately, the answer is it's complicated, but a shortened version is, all things being equal, longer is a bit better than shorter.
Got it. Thanks, everybody. I always thought that. I just wanted to make sure that longer is always better than shorter, in this case, anyway. So, back to Net and Andy's half corner.
Okay, I just want to give Jim one more opportunity if he stepped back in front of the radio. KD2VHD, he signed in earlier. So, Jim, if you're out there, what's your question or your topic? Okay, nothing heard. I guess he was needed elsewhere. Andy, WA2CDL, with your mini Andy's Corner for tonight, please.
All right, very good. Boy, thanks, WA2CDL, returning. Well, you know, I like yourself, I like reading articles in various magazines, which I get. And once in a while, I come across an article which is intriguing. So I thought I would just share it tonight. Not really Andy's Corner per se, but you can call it that if you want. I don't know how many people out there get QST. I actually don't get it, but I have a friend who gives me his. So I save the money because QST has gone up in price. I don't know what it is now for a subscription, for a year subscription. Because actually I'm not a member of the ARRL, but I have been in the past. Anyway, I have this QST from August of 2021, just a few months ago. And, you know, there's an article, or there's a column. It's now by Steve Ford, WB8IMY. Who wrote this article or published it in QST. And it's called, he calls it ECLECTIC, Eclectic Technology. And this particular one it says, super sharp RF filtering with light. Now, I know, Roy, you like, light is an interesting subject, so I thought that maybe, if you haven't read this, I would read it. Dealing with light. Can I go on?
Sure.
Okay, I wouldn't be surprised if you already saw this article and maybe read it. But, you know, we live in this age where technology is moving at the speed of light. And I have to say that. Things change so fast, it's very hard to keep up with all the technologies and all the research that's been going on in various universities around the world and experimentation. And it's all because of, us, hams that are curious. because Dick has said many times, we are curious people. We want to know how things work. So, this goes on to say, and I'll be brief about it, not take up too much time, it's only 9:15. It says, the latest advance in photonics brings light into the RF realm. Researchers at the University of, it's I don't know how to pronounce the word, T-W-E-N-T-E, T-W-E-N-T-E, I'm not good at pronouncing words. Maybe you could help me with that. It's in the Netherlands. Have applied photonics to the task of RF filters, to the task of filtering RF signals. How do you pronounce T-W-E-N-T-E, Roy?
It's 20. I think it's a city in the Netherlands.
I was going to say 20, but I wasn't sure. Does this sound familiar? Have you read this article, Roy, just as a question?
I do not recall it. Perhaps as you describe it more, it'll get refreshed in my brain.
Okay, I was just curious because I know that you do a lot of reading and research. And, of course, you know, this applies to, things in the future that, your latest, software-defined radio is constantly changing. They're coming out with new features and new modes and new ways of communicating. And David was asking about, the cost of all this and how it's free and everything else. You know, when you put it in perspective, I just purchased four Bofang radios, the UV5Rs, for $60, and that's four of them. They're like $20 a piece or $30 a piece. So, it's unheard of where, years ago you could never buy a radio that cheap. And it's amazing how they mass produce these radios because of the technology that does it. Anyway, let me continue with this.
Are you talking about microwave photonics?
Yes, it does touch that subject, Wesley. Yes, it does.
I said it was by Professor Marpauk David at University of 20.
It doesn't mention the name of the professor, but the researchers have at that university have done it. So, let me just read the article, and then you guys can discuss it. Because if you haven't read it, it's interesting. Okay. So, they have applied photonics to the task of filtering our signals, creating flexible, programmable filters with almost unbelievably sharp contours. According to reports, these filters function at frequencies well into the microwave range. So there's your statement, Wesley, that they've been experimenting in the microwave region with these filters. So they actually came up with a programmable optical signal processor. And they describe how this works, which is what the article is about. Okay, I'm watching the time here because I'll make it quick. A programmable photonic chip. At the heart of their breakthrough is a silicon chip that is capable of processing light itself. And they show a little figure here where you take an optical source, in this case it's a laser, and you're putting it into a modulator, and then you are applying RF at the same time. So now you have a modulated RF light frequency, laser light frequency that's being modulated by RF. And that's what the picture shows here. So it says, first, you use the RF signal to modulate the output of a laser. The RF-modulated light is fed to the photonic chip, where it is essentially disassembled according to the frequency of the light. And that's what the chip does. I guess it just breaks it apart. The separate parts, like the radio sidebands around, and the wording may not be right the way he worded this, but I'm just reading it. The separate parts, like the radio sidebands around the optical frequency, can then be processed separately. When all photonic processing is done and the desired spectral shape is created, the light is recombined and converted back into a radio frequency signal. Okay, I'm not sure if Ed is out there also, because maybe he read this. The conversion back to RF takes place through a special high-speed detector. All right, now keep in mind, this is just, you know, I'm just giving you food for thought, you know, because in the future, you know, you're going to see this stuff on the market. You're going to see radios that have these processors and operating at light frequencies and filterings and, you know, and it's endless what, you know, these things are capable of doing, and that's what the article goes on to say, so I'll continue. So it says, if this technology, and it says if this technology makes it into transceivers, the result would be RF filters capable of enhancing reception to a level that would be difficult to imagine today. Now, can you imagine that? Which, you know, if this technology makes it into transceivers, so the point is, your transceiver of the future will have this technology and this filtering, and that you just can't imagine the capabilities. It is incredible. I'll pause here just to ask Roy. Have you read about this what I've read so far? Back to you.
Andy, can I interject something?
Yeah, go ahead. Go. Say whatever you want.
Somebody being too EAP to keep it legal. I have some thoughts on this. I have some pluses and some minuses. I think it might be very useful, just not ham radio, but I'll wait till Roy gives it over to me officially. Or if he doesn't.
Okay, this is AC2GS. I haven't read the QST article, at least I don't recall reading the QST article. I have read articles. It's somewhat esoteric, and the devices look simple on the surface. The basic underlying theory it's based on is a heck of a lot more complicated than this sort of two-dimensional design of a lot of the structures. I'd love to hear Ed's opinion. I think this is kind of really early times. If anything, a lot of the amateur radio type of technology is trying to make things all digitized. They're trying to creep that analog to digital converter as close to the antenna as humanly possible. So I guess there's always a place for an RF filter, and this might be a great opportunity for a much more selective one. But I'd love to hear Ed's take on all this.
Yeah. Okay. First of all, for ham radio as we know it today, for years I've been reading stuff about SDR, and until a couple of years ago, I said, yeah, interesting. But a couple of years ago, they finally got it right. What SDR has done that helps hams, not so much on VHF, UHF, but on the low bands, where you want extremely adjustable selectivity. I mean, in the old days, you could buy, I mean, the cat's pajamas, as they said, was a receiver with a crystal filter and maybe even a phasing adjustment so you could tweak through the filtering. But they finally got it right for ham radio and similar applications with variable filtering. My Yaesu FT891, I've spoken on the air, that I think is fantastic, allows you to select the exact filtering you want to match the exact conditions you need. And as far as I'm concerned, for ham radio, we have achieved the ultimate. Anything more may be possible, but this is what I've wanted all my life. Let's take what you're talking about, Andy. The SDR processing has a limited maximum frequency, and I think that's where it comes in, to expand the frequency noise drop. I think what they're saying is, you can build a laser where you take a microwave signal at RF, modulate the laser, feed it through some optical filtering, and I'm thinking of something like using interference patterns, which can be microscopically small, yet very accurate, and then have some kind of a photosensor reconstitute the microwave, and you can kind of use SDR techniques, but using like an interference type of thing to cause, you know, summing and sums and differences. That's what I think that would lend itself to, much higher frequencies than hams are using today. Right?
Well, I mean, I don't see the limitations that you mentioned for software-defined radios as kind of built in stone. The frequency limitations are based on the current technology of analog to digital converters. If you're able to get the resolutions and the frequency ranges, the sampling rates high enough, I can't see any particular limitation. It's just, you know, getting the silicon to do those tricks.
Point. The processing has the same kind of limitations as the A to D.
Okay, to a degree, but I think that's the big pain in the backside. And some designers are playing games with the anti-aliasing filters to be able to detect multiples above the usual sampling rate of the ADCs. But it's always good to have faster processors. Ultimately, you're kind of downsampling it to a reasonable size, unless you want something like a federal radio that's able to record across a very, very wide band spectrum of frequencies at the same time. Then you need a lot of processing power. I'll agree with you.
I just want to... Before I go, I know Leslie's out there. Let me just finish the rest of this article, and then I'll give the reasons why I'm mentioning this in the first place.
Sure, Andy, please.
I know I interrupted because I just wanted to just see if you read this, but in my opinion, the reason why this is actually in QST is because it says, if this technology makes it into transceivers, you know, the transceiver of the future, not now, but the future, you know, it would be, it says it would be difficult to imagine today the enhanced reception that we're going to get, that we'll have at our fingertips, you know. So that's the reason why this article actually appears in QST, because we're hams and we want to know. And that's what this whole TechNet is about, is to discuss this, to talk about stuff that's coming out in the future and the changes about. So that's why I'm mentioning it. All right, so let me just continue because it goes into a little bit of how this works.
I have an idea, Andy.
Yeah, go ahead.
GPS with its sub-noise level detection might be improved with that.
I'm sure that's been thought of also. You know, given where we are now with software-defined, given the limitations that Roy just mentioned, because everything has a limit to it,
But we're advancing at such a fast rate that this technology that I'm talking about does exist. This technology exists, right, and will eventually make its way. All right, so let me just finish the article, then you guys can continue. Okay, so, again, this is all food for thought. That's all it is. It says, in quotes, don't cross the streams. As Dr. Peter Van Kaman, if I'm saying it right, warned in the movie Ghostbusters. Oh, yeah, I remember that. Crossing the streams generated by their proton packs would have unfortunate consequences. It says researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, are defying this famous admonition by twisting streams of laser light using optical antennas made of concentric rings roughly equal to the diameter of a human hair. Okay, so, you know, now you're getting you're getting a better idea, because they're doing something that's the diameter of a human hair, so you can see what kind of research they're doing on this. Okay, so through this technique, they have tremendously increased the amount of information that can be multiplexed or simultaneously transmitted by a coherent light source. One technique for increasing the information a light source can transmit is to use polarization, where light waves are separated into horizontal or vertical orientations. This effectively doubles the amount of information transmitted.
It's called polarization.
That's what I said.
Yeah, well, most of us are familiar with that. Anybody with sunglasses, anyway.
I know, but it mentions this. You know, it's just, I'm just reading what it mentions. All right, I'm almost done with this. So the Berkeley scientists have taken the next step by using orbital angular momentum. They call it, it's abbreviated OAM instead. So they're using OAM instead of what I just mentioned. To achieve this with light, however, they needed to create a special optical antenna, a topological, it's what they call a topological antenna, TOPOLOGICAL, topological antenna. That's what they created. To make the topological antenna, the researchers used electron beam lithography to etch a grid pattern onto an indium gallium arsenide phosphide. Okay. See, now we're talking about a little bit of chemistry, which is what Roy likes to talk about. It's phosphide, not phosphate, phosphide. And then bonded the structure into a surface made of iridium iron garnet, which I've heard of. That's used in transistors, by the way. The researchers designed the grid to form quantum wells in a pattern of three concentric circles, the largest about 50 microns in diameter, to trap protons. Now, talk about, some sophisticated talk here. I just gave you a mouthful.
Wait a minute, we went from light to protons?
KG2RY.
Yes, okay, one more quick paragraph, then you guys can talk about it. Okay, because I'm just about done. So this is just explaining what they've done here, what the researchers have done. By applying a magnetic field perpendicular to their two-dimensional microstructure, the researchers successfully, and that's a good word, successfully generated three OAM laser beams, and OAM is the orbital angular momentum, laser beams, having in circular orbits above the surface. The amount of information such a system could carry would be phenomenal. Okay, end of paragraph. End of article. Okay, Roy, back to you for your comments and pass it around. I know it sounds technical, but I find it fascinating. Back to you, W8CDO.
AC2GS, yes, it is very technical. It makes me feel a lot better when I bring up my technical thing in a little while. But I think you meant it produces photons. It doesn't produce protons. It's a photonic generator. So, it, you know, very interesting, very kind of esoteric. It's material that's used in semiconductors, used in capacitive operating touch screens, indium. Indium tin is the usual material. It's, it produces a transparent but conductive layer on the glass. But it's also used for a lot of semiconductor materials. So it's fascinating. I think it's kind of early, and it's really esoteric.
Boy, 3 seconds.
I tell you what, I'll give you five.
If it's photons, not protons, at least they haven't suddenly gone off on a tangent. Let me give you an experiment that you can run at home. Take a drop of oil, put it on some water. Sometimes you'll find rain on a roadway, gets a little bit of oil, and you see these rainbow patterns. That's interferometry. If they can... what's the word? Utilize that. I think that's what they're talking about, and I think the rest of it is trying to baffle you.
Well, I don't know if QST wants to baffle anyone, but they certainly did get into the weeds where they're discussing the nature of the design materials and such. You know, I mean, you could probably go through most of the ARRL manual without them discussing in minute detail the technical nature of producing operational semiconductors, which are fascinating, and we have had discussions of it here on the net, you know, too much of that in a book for people who just want to know how to get on the radio, and it gives people headaches. But, yeah, they did get somewhat esoteric, which is curious. I mean, you know, it's not like people at home are going to be starting to, you know, get themselves some indium and some arsenide and whip up a mixture of chips themselves.
And also, GaAsP is a classic used for making LEDs, and YIG has been used in electronic warfare equipment for decades and decades. It's a form of ferrite.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's unusual that materials don't kind of have a prehistory before they're modified ever so slightly. A lot of these materials have been researched for decades upon decades to find effective uses for them, sometimes to great benefits. And yes, gallium arsenide phosphate is usually a common component of a low-noise preamp circuit. A lot of us probably own one.
Yes, W8CDL. Gallium arsenide is used in, like you say, low-noise FETs, the FET amplifiers that advanced receiver research, ARC, ACC. Yeah, Advanced Receiver Research made those amplifiers using those type of FETs, with that chemical structure. That's what I'm trying to say. And by the way, I did say photons, not protons, because it might have sounded like pro, but it's photon. That's what I said. All right, back to you.
Okay, Ed, if you need a few more seconds, if you have anything else you'd like to say on the subject.
Hang on a sec, Wesley. My take is, as I said before, you use a laser, some kind of optical interferometry, which you can run your own experiment with a drop of oil on some water and see how the optical stuff is changed in a thousandth of an inch. My guess is they're doing something like that to achieve some very selective filtering at very high frequencies, limited only by the modulation rate that the laser and the demodulator can handle. That's my feeling. That's like getting my gut out of that. I think the rest of it is all just trying to snow the listener so that they think that these people are really, really, really smart. Wesley, if it's okay with Roy, I'm over to Wesley, WB2AB.
Yeah, thank you very much. You're giving us a wealth of information. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. But, ironically, it's much less complicated than you think about. And this is not the first technology. It's the parallel technology to many technologies in these areas. So if you recall how the transopter is working, it's a chip. It does have a photodiode and the photo transistor in it. So instead of just having a photodiode that is sending the signal 1 or 0, and that light goes to the photo transistor like in old times 20 years ago, you have it all in one chip. Let me jump. So now we have a reverse situation. Instead of, and that works as an isolator. So that chip works like an isolator. You can send the signal to the diode inside the chip. The phototransistor is seeing that signal and is switching on and off. Now we have a reverse situation. We have the RF signal. And inside of that chip, actually, we have a light-sensitive device, which could be a phototransistor. But they don't use the phototransistor. They use just a device that is modulating the light. So you're sending the RF to the mixer. In that mixer, you have a string of light. And that's what you were talking about, that is thin like an air. It's not an antenna. All the on the light, if it's a plasma. Yeah, plasma is conductive, then you can have the wavelength go of the antenna matching if you can limit that laser beam, but we're not talking about it. So now, we deliver to that sort of mixer modulator the radio frequency signal, and then we modulating that light. And that light is sent through the series of programmable optical signal processors. Be that what we want to do with it. So if we operate from between 15 to 25 gigahertz,
my gigahertz
sensitive of modulation, a phase of a modulation, and we have we are pretty much experienced with phase modulation, and intensity of modulation with the amplitude modulation. If we operate in the frequency from
3 megahertz,
we might be interested with tunable bandpass filter, which would be actually
27.33 megahertz,
about the same frequency range from 2 to 10. We could have a higher rejection notch filter, or
at 73 dB.
That would could create. And that is actually the development between years 2020 and 2021. Now, that light is then directed to the detector that is detecting the light. And now this detector is actually acting as a transopter, which is the light now is
transistorized.
transistor that is inside of the end of chip. And then we have the electrical signal. And then
coming out my arse?
Out. We can amplify it and send it out. That's how it works. So the technology by universes of 20 was actually directed for a frequency of 14 gigahertz.
My gigahertz?
To use over 2 octave frequency coverage. But, so they...
It hurts real bad.
Gigahertz, and eventually from 6 gigahertz up to 14 gigahertz, with ranging from 55 dBA extinction notch filter that is implemented.
25 dB?
And I'm already trying to finish. So if we are interested, because we can do many things with it, there is a...
Many things?
Another a similar technology to this one that was done by Jiang and Yang in 2018, and they achieved filtering with tunable resolution from 300 megahertz to 25 gigahertz. So we're not talking about the bandwidth, we're talking about the resolution. And they were using various filtering shapes of multiple bandpass filters. And the last quote. In Nature of Photonics, there is an article, Integrated Microwave Photonics.
Photoresistor.
People, not by University of 20. And it says, hybrid material platforms to enhance light-matter interaction.
Infrared detector.
High bandwidth electro-optic modulators. So that was what I was describing you is actually the modulator. Why the...
Decoupled modulator.
This is the last lecture. So low noise frequency synthesizers and cheap signal processors with the orders of magnitude enhanced spectral resolutions. And then...
The magnitude processor.
But I think it would be too much. Thank you very much. And to Xia.
Okay, thank you, Wes. Andy, I want to thank you for the presentation tonight. It was interesting, and I'm going to have to do some more research. By the way, year's dues to the ARRL, which includes QSD, are $49 if anyone's interested out there. And also, if you want to read a paper on the subject, if you go to my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, I have a link to a PDF file where you can read about the technology as well.
All right, let me just say one closing thought. Okay, I didn't say all this to start any wars or anything between the different thoughts and ideas that people have as far as technology is concerned, but I only mentioned it because if it made its way to QSD, then there's got to be a reason. And the guy, Steve Ford, who's actually written many articles. He's pretty well known in QSD. And when he said it, that this will eventually make its way into transceivers, that's a good possibility, or what have you. So I just thought, again, just food for thought. That's all it is. All right, 73, thanks for letting me in. And if I find any more interesting articles from time to time, I will convey them with your permission. Thanks, Roy, W8CDL.
Roy, can I just quickly elaborate on one point I made that I think may be relevant?
Sure, Ed.
I don't want to come off as being hostile to what Andy said, quite the opposite. I think there's something very useful there where it might allow some very special purpose stuff. What I mentioned to is what a lot of people don't realize is with a standard receiver tuned to GPS frequencies, there's nothing there. You have to have the modulation information and generate the proper signals in a computer to drag it out of the noise. You're simulating like a tenth of a hertz bandwidth on the carrier to decode anything meaningful. So any kind of an improvement along those lines, I think that's where it might lend itself very well. You follow that?
Yeah, I understand.
So I'm just saying, this may have very real applications. I'm just saying, don't wait for on 20-meter SSB.
Okay, I mean, that's reasonable. A lot of research and development is ends up in somewhat niche products. Not everything can be applied across the board. The ARRL, this column that Andy is reading from is a curious new invention of QST. They also published the article about people doing RF research that suggests a possible benefit for Alzheimer's. So these articles to me are a little bit more speculative than the usual article that we read in QST about firm science that's been commercialized for years. Anyway, want to thank Andy, want to thank Ed for his insight, and Wesley for his description. I want to try a little experiment, see if I could coax you all into a little rabbit hole of conceptualization. If anyone has the opportunity and went to Roy's link, which is at roy.ac2gs.com, there's a lovely little cartoon that kind of demonstrates Ohm's law, or the principles of what voltage, current, and resistance are. They have these little cartoon characters, and they draw the analogy that it's a hydraulic phenomena, that voltage is the pressure, ohms, the resistance to flow, is a constriction in the pipe, and amps, current, is the volume of fluid that goes through the pipes. That's a nice little picture. It gets the point across. But my question for you guys and ladies out there is electrical energy transferred in the same way that water flows through a pipe? In other words, is the mechanism of transfer of electrical energy via a conductor with the flow of charged particles going through it? So I'd love to hear people's opinion on that.
WHCDL, I've seen this picture. Let me just explain.
Okay, Andy.
I just saw this recently. I don't remember where I saw it, what magazine I saw it in, but I believe they actually showed, you know, the current, the voltage, the resistance as stick figures of people. And what I recall is I'm just going to convey what I recall, because I don't have the picture in front of me, is I think it shows the electrons flowing in a pipe. And it shows the resistance stick figure is squeezing the pipe, squeezing it together, which is showing which is supposed to show more resistance in that particular location of the pipe where he's squeezing it, and that is being, you know, transferred to that the resistance of the flow to current. That's what I recall as far as what I saw. Am I correct about that? I think that's what it is.
Yes, that's what it is. So what it does is it teaches by analogy, and the analogy is that the flow of electrical energy is akin to the flow of any fluid. And I guess the takeaway that some people have is that electrons are simply another form of fluid. Instead of a pipe, they're flowing through the conductor of a piece of wire.
So is that the answer to the question? Because I don't remember the question. Or what did you want? Well.